All right, hi everybody, and welcome to Lecture 56 in this American History Program of History at Our House for the Junior and Senior High. We are going to proceed with our story of the American Revolution unfolding here. We are reaching the stage of outright rebellion today. Before we do that, however, we're going to keep on revisiting this question of what we need to know, what we need to retain, what we need to maintain as a part of our operating context of knowledge as we study the past. As we, you know, we have to build this tower of knowledge, if we can, rather than just have a random pile of knowledge bricks lying around. If we're going to build a tower, we need a foundation, we need a structure, and we've been building it. We are building the foundation. We started out with a very limited selection of anchor facts, which we have seen repeatedly coming back and helping us to understand things that we encounter. This is what anchor facts do. Just taking us back to our anchor fact, this is our evolving anchor fact timeline, right? But what we've been seeing is that throughout our story, we refer back to ideas and events and changes that are embodied by these anchor facts. At every step of the story, we're talking about American history. Well, that simply does not happen without the discovery of America by Columbus. That simply does not happen without the colonization of Jamestown and Plymouth. That simply does not happen, well, pretty much without everything that you see here in some significant sense. And or it simply doesn't make sense. There's one of two things. Either we can't understand how it happened without reference to these facts, or we can't understand what it means without reference to these facts. So, in other words, give you an example, right? Manet's Narmer. Could you say, does it sound like a reasonable statement to make? There could be no United States of America without the unification of Egypt by Manet's Narmer. Is that a phrase that we would use? I mean, we've used it so many times with regard to the discovery of America by Columbus, for instance. Alexander?
No, not really, I don't think.
No, it does not follow at all that's a necessary, that it's not a precursor to America, right? In fact, I mean, to the extent that the founders did not know Egyptian history, for one thing. But we might be able to, you know, some historian might be able to argue that Egypt developed certain institutions and transmitted certain values, this and that, to other people. But the truth is, no, it's not fundamentally important. For instance, even with regard to written language, which Egypt and Mesopotamia were the first places to develop written language, those forms of written language were not the ones that eventually were adopted in the West. So if we look back on the evolution of the language that we use, we know that Latin, right, is one of the key foundational languages of modern languages. Before that was Greek, and they have a related alphabet and so on. And the Greeks learned their system of writing from a people called the Phoenicians. So we call our alphabet the Phoenician alphabet, in fact. But obviously it has nothing to do with Egyptian hieroglyphics, right? So no, it would be beyond a stretch. It really just is. There's a chasm between us and the Egyptians. There's no causal connection. There's nothing that we owe the Egyptians credit for. And to say, oh yeah, without you guys, we wouldn't have been able to do this. On the other hand, we absolutely can look back on the Roman Republic and say, oh my gosh, had the Romans not done that, there would be no United States today. Now that's an amazing fact. It's amazing, but it is true. It is true. Likewise, without the Athenians, the same applies. In fact, in a sense, the Greeks are way more important than the Romans, because the Greeks were philosophers and historians. They were the ones who wrote it all down and taught us to study our human past and learn from it. The Romans didn't invent that. They picked that up from the Greeks, like so much else. So, without those people, we would not be who we are. So that is deep and profound. Here we are in the 2015, and the truth of the matter is, we could not live the lives we are leading without the contribution of the Greeks and the Romans. Right? But we can't say that of Venice and Armor. It doesn't always add up that way. But sometimes events from the past matter in another sense. They matter in the sense of showing us, helping us to have a wider picture, helping us to have a broader understanding, which forms the context for our understanding and appreciation of the things that we have. So in other words, how valuable is American freedom? Right, there's an interesting question. There's an interesting topic. What is the nature of it? How great is America exactly? How do you answer that? It's a matter of, well, I mean, imagine if the world had 50 Americas in it. Although every continent had one, every continent had a country dedicated to individual rights. Every continent had people who were free and productive and wealthy and happy, and everything was just, you know, exactly the same over and over again. Repeat. Well, at that point, what would be the significance of America? It would still be good, right? But what would be changed? Let's see if you remember these key words that have to do with historical thinking. What's the thing that would change, Juliet?
It would no longer be unique.
Yes, but unique, it leads us to another idea. Being unique is part of something else. What is that term concerning the fact that it's so important to pay attention to it? Keen?
I would have said important.
Important, yes, exactly. Imagine if the world had 50 United States of Americas in it, with different names, obviously. They were all pretty much interchangeable. At what point is that important? Now, which one of them would you say is important, right? I mean, at that point, the significance of the United States would really be reduced. Keen?
Well, I suppose if the United States came first and then everyone else...
Form,
then it would be useful to study it.
Absolutely. But even so, Keen, even if the United States was the first, like in 1776, America declares independence, and then every 5 years after that, there's a new America born, and they're all just as great as the original one. It's still, the significance of that then continues to die, it becomes just one in the many, right? So it's really, I get your point that there's another way of looking at it, is that if it was the first and as a result it was the cause of the others, then yeah, in some sense, then its importance would increase. So that's a good, that's a well-taken point, Keen. But if that wasn't the case, or if there just were a whole bunch of them, then of course it wouldn't matter nearly as much. So that's where Manes and Armor comes in. That's where the barbarians of the Dark Ages comes in. That's where all of the context for American history is things that are not part of American history, but which help us to understand the significance of American history. So those are also anchor facts, because without them, we can't understand the importance of what we're looking at. And as a result, also, if you don't think something is important, And I have to wage this war of conviction on all our behalfs, right? Because if I don't manage to convince you guys, what happens after this? What happens after Memorial Day? And one more year of history at our house has passed, and we have the history at our house diaspora. Everybody goes all over the place. What happens? It all just dissolves. And it won't really matter to you. And you'll forget it. And you might remember enjoying a particular class, or might remember enjoying the course and everything. But pretty soon it just kind of disappears. And you forget all about it. And so, I mean, so It's a really big job in a sense that I've got, which is to insist, to invite you to not give up on this and to really, truly make it a part of you and your life and how you think. So I've got a big job to continue to build this base of knowledge for you and to help you to see what it's worth. And to try to help you to build something that actually will last. So that over time, whether or not you're going to stay with the program, or you might branch out, go somewhere else, or you might just, you know, have to get some credits to go to college or whatever, you know, you go your own way, but it'll stick with you. And at some point, when you're done jumping through hoops and stuff, which a lot of life involves jumping through other people's hoops, and you're trying to understand the world around you and taking it more seriously as an independent adult, you might turn back to it. And you'll be better equipped than anybody else to do something with it. Because you'll have this memory that there was a teacher that told you that history actually matters and that did his best to actually make the case. And who knows, you might still have the binder in a box somewhere in the attic, and you can pull it down and you'll have something to work from. Now, by then, by the way, I will have written multiple books, so you'll have a lot of really cool stuff to read as well as an adult. So still working on my first book right now, but it's going to be great, and you'll have a lot more resources. But anyway, pulling things back to our immediate context, we're building a tower of knowledge. And my hope is to build one that's as impressive as possible, so that you can impress yourself, so that you can look at what you know and actually admire it and admire yourself for knowing it. And want to go from there and build more, because there is more, a lot more. And it's really amazing stuff. And it's worthy of your attention. Human history is a marvelous, intricate, rich story that just will never disappoint you. When you're ready to really learn it in depth, it will be a very rewarding experience for you if you're capable. So how do we build from here, right? We've got this, all that to say. We've got this new set of candidate facts, and we're saying, well, okay, which ones do we add? And we've sorted and sifted and looked at all this, and we said, okay, we've got some good candidates here. We're down to less than about 10, and in particular, we've noticed that there's a group of things here that all pertain to a really hugely, there's no way to exaggerate it, significant theme in human civilization. And that is the question of religious toleration and religious freedom. We are living through an era in which that is an essential problem. Now it has to do with the relationship between civilizations, between two whole civilizations. In the Western past, in America's past, it primarily had to do with religious relations inside of a civilization. It had to do with the fact that Christianity broke up into multiple sects, and Christians almost killed each other, almost eradicated each other over those differences between them. That's amazing, daunting, and hugely significant today. It's part of why Americans and Westerners have such difficulty in dealing with radical Islam today. It's such a difficult question because we've already been through so much learning with regard to the importance of toleration and the importance of freedom. And it becomes a really difficult question. How do you deal with people who don't share those values and interact with them and safeguard your civilization at the same time as trying to promote certain values and trying to develop just a better way of life and help others to recognize it and so on? It's huge. So the question is, which of these facts will serve us the most in doing that? And I'm going to phrase the question for you now very specifically to lead you to a new thought that we haven't had yet. Notice the phrasing, okay? See if you can get the hint. Which of these single facts should we add above all others in order to promote our learning of American history? Which of these individual facts would serve us the best in building our tower of knowledge? Keen thinks he might be ready to take this one on. Timothy maybe too. All right, I'll start with Timothy. Go ahead, Timothy.
All right. For American history, a single fact that I think would be the best for help us study America is 1634, George Calvert founds Maryland, the first colonies to support religious toleration, because that sparks the idea of religious toleration in America.
Okay. If there was an answer, that might very well be it. So it's a very good answer, Timothy. You went along with my question, you accepted my premise, and you came up with a good answer. Right? This is Americanism. This is the American way of looking at these questions, involves tolerationism and freedom. And a good way to look at that would be, well, where did that first begin? And to say, well, the first place where this was embodied in the conduct of colonists was Maryland. So, yep, that's a good answer as far as that goes. Okay? But there's a problem with it, and I'm going to see if King can detect. Go ahead.
For now, I cast my vote with 1584. Richard Hakluyt writes the Discourse on Western Planting.
Okay, why?
And that is because without, you know, we can't get colonies if the Europe or England in particular doesn't look at America and say, well, we might be able to do something with this.
All right, so that's another potential offering of a single fact. All right, so both of you guys went along with me here, and in the way that I asked the question, I said, which of these single facts is going to be the best choice if we were to choose a single fact? And, well, the problem with both of these answers, even though they're I agree with both of you, actually, with regard to, potentially, if we were to pick a single fact, which one would be the best? I think you guys just took the two best. So, well done in that regard, if you're gonna pick a single one. But the problem is this. These are not... 1634, for instance, is not an anchor fact in and of itself. It is, Timothy, it's not a good answer in the sense that when you encounter that fact, it doesn't help you to answer questions. What it does is it raises questions. In other words, you say, okay, I'm going to memorize this and I'm going to use it as an attempt to use it as a foundation for knowledge. And George Calvert founds a colony for religious toleration for Anglicans and Catholics. Does anybody see why this immediately is not a foundational fact? And what, why not? And why not? Alexander?
Because it raises questions of who are you making this religious toleration for? You don't have anything about separate religions. The only anchor fact you have before that is the 4BC, where it was just one religion.
Yeah, exactly. This becomes now not a foundational awareness, but rather a puzzle that you are creating, and you're actually confused. It's going to end up being confusing for you, not helpful, because you look to the birth of Jesus, and there's nothing there that says there would be a certain kind of Christianity just for England. Right, so if you're going to pick a colony, the first colony of Anglicans and Catholics, if you're going to have this, well, you've got a serious issue. Where did this come from? So you now have a piece of, you're proposing an awareness of the past that's unfounded, right? The foundation of which, the underlying awareness of which isn't there. So you would need this fact. That's why I put this in an indentation, right? Because you need this fact in order to explain this fact. Hey, it's actually kind of cool. I never noticed that before, but they're exactly 100 years apart. So you need this fact to understand this fact, which means that this is absolutely a more powerful anchor. Then 1534 is a more important anchor than 1634. You see my point, Timothy? It's a matter of, remember how we've talked about in the past of hierarchy? Anchors are the hierarchical foundations of knowledge. In other words, they're the things you need to know that will help you to know other things. And whereas these derivative items of knowledge, like the founding of Maryland, that can't stand on its own because it, you can't understand it without referring back to the founding of Anglicanism, 1534. So, no, 1634 won't do. And then Richard Hakluyt's discourse, Keane is proposing, well, that has to do with colonization. I'm going to return to that one afterwards. But I'm going to focus on this for the moment, Keane, because the same point applies to that in a certain way. But notice what This issue with Timothy chose 1634, but you can't have that without 1534. So then, is it 1534? Is that the answer? Can anybody see why? I'll give you guys another hint. There was a trap in my question. I laid you guys a trap and you fell in it, which is okay. I'm very tricky that way. I said, what single fact is most useful? Alexander?
Well, 1534 is only one of the three new religions, and the other ones also spread around, and George Calvert founded Maryland, and there was Calvinism too with Roger Williams and stuff like that.
There you go. You're on the right track here. So the answer is, there is no single fact that will do. There is none. See, because you could say, looking back over at these, and you could say, well, oh, this, we'll choose this one. We'll choose Martin Luther. Because obviously, the other ones wouldn't have happened if Martin Luther hadn't really, you know, got the ball rolling. He's the most important. And if you ask me, that's true. So, you know, in terms of history, the advent of Lutheranism is the thing that initiates the Reformation. So, yes, I think that's a true statement. However, just being aware that Lutheranism is formed is not going to serve you very well when you're studying American history. Why? It's really actually going to lead you completely astray. right? Why is, I mean, Luther is absolutely the most important figure of the Reformation. Why is that not helpful? Why is that by itself not an anchor fact? Keen?
Well, we don't see much Lutheranism, if any, in the climate of colonization.
Exactly. Exactly. So yeah, I mean, there are Lutheran churches in America, but the truth is Lutheranism was the dominant sect in Scandinavia and northern Germany. And was that the home base of American colonization? No. That was relatively insignificant. Only later, in the 19th century, was there a significant movement of Lutherans into the United States, and well after the founding. So, wait, Timothy says something about... Yes, it was. Timothy, go ahead.
Oh, no, that was just a joke.
Oh, joke. Okay, no joking right now. it wasn't. So this is a problem. So... Tomorrow, we've spent a lot of time on this, but it's a good topic. I'm trying to challenge you to think about this here. One fact will not do, because the Reformation has three crucial sects. None of them, we can't dispense with any of them, right? Would it make sense for us to study Luther, but to have some kind of awareness of the origin of Lutheranism, but then to just jettison Calvin? Does that make sense? For American history? That would be perverse. I mean, because the Puritans were Calvinists. And they are considered, rightly considered, crucial contributors to the story of American colonization, right? I mean, we wouldn't understand America without them. We can't understand Roger Williams without them. And the value of toleration without having a context of intolerance, of which, sadly, they remained representatives. So, there's something else that we need here. See, we're encountering a problem, and I'm going to tell you, I'm going to hint at the answer before we leap back into our story of American Revolution. When studying history, it does not do, it's not good enough, it's not sufficient to just merely pile up anchor facts. It's not enough. The method of anchor facts is a great one, and I'm very proud to have invented it, and I'm even going to try to trademark it. But it's not enough. It's not enough. We need more. We cannot interact with history and derive meaning from it solely by juggling single events. History's meaning can't be transmitted by that mechanism, by the manipulation of single events. That's like, I like to kind of compare it to juggling, right? If you want to try to understand history using single events, well, you get one event, that's like juggling one ball, no problem. Two events, that's like two balls, and then three balls, and then four balls. And so what happens if you insist on interacting with the past on the level of individual events? It's like you're trying to juggle too many balls. You start to drop them. It becomes impossible to actually build a structure. It's not a structure anymore. It becomes this attempt to maintain a lot of separate pieces of knowledge that don't fit together, and it breaks down. So there is a solution, I'm glad to announce. There is a solution. Anchor facts are awesome, and they're a great method, but there's a problem here that we can see arising, that we can't take this one by itself, we can't take this one by itself, and we can't take this one by itself. So what are we going to do? Are we going to take all three And then, are we going to take these two later, and these two later, and pretty soon, we're studying American history, and I'm asking you to remember 75 anchor facts. Obviously, it won't work. Timothy?
Well, I'm not sure this might be the right thing to do, but we could combine those three anchor facts into one anchor fact, like you did with the ancient Athens and ancient Rome. That's technically one anchor fact, but you can merge three facts into one anchor.
No, nice try. Oh, you're right on the right. That's excellent, Timothy. You're on the right track. No, these are two anchor facts. They just happen to be I've twinned them, right? But it's like a set of twins in a family. They're not exactly the same, and it's disrespectful to treat them as being the same, right? You got to remember, Athens is 508, Rome was 509. Rome is a republic, Athens is a democracy. They are distinctive facts, and they just happen to be linked by and similarly down here, Jamestown and Plymouth are two separate facts, and one of them happens in one year and another happens in another year. I just happen to have done something. I've grouped them together. I've paired them. That's the right word. I've paired them, and so that's useful. They are a pair of facts, and that's, you're heading in the right direction, Timothy. That's excellent. And Alexander's also got an element of the solution. He calls it generalizing, but that is not the right word, because we are not going to render our awareness more general. In fact, we're going to do something to render our awareness more precisely specific, which is a very interesting phenomenon, but I'll teach it to you guys in the coming weeks. So it's going to be a powerful method that will take us beyond anchor facts. Okay, so hopefully you're interested to know what that might be. But boy, we got to get moving here. Pardon me for organizing this whole thing, right? We've arrived at 1775 with Patrick Henry's Declaration of Liberty, as I like to call it. Give me liberty! Or give me death. Well, what brought this man to such a dramatic declaration? How could it be that in 1775 a British citizen would make such a declaration, essentially against his king? Well, that was the whole lead up to the story, right? All the way up to 1775, we have an escalation that generally just adds up to tyranny. And the constant, just continuous trend towards greater and greater power over the citizens by the British government. So, recognizing that this was never going to dissipate or abate, Patrick Henry declared, look, it's time for us to take this seriously. It's time for us to recognize that this is leading to chains and slavery. And then he predicted, very prophetically, the next gale that sweeps from the north will bring to our ears the clash of resounding arms. Our brethren are already in the field. Why stand we here idle? In other words, the next time we hear of news from Massachusetts, it's going to be that people are shooting at each other. He was absolutely right. What followed just 1 month later was the crucial initiating battles of the American Revolution, the battles of Lexington and Concord. So if we look on a map of Massachusetts, and of course we have Boston here, which is the main city. Then we have over here two crucial important sites, Concord and Lexington. And the reason why these sites are that figure prominently at the beginning of the Revolutionary War is that there was a store of military supplies at Concord. Meaning the British government maintained armories, maintained warehouses of military supplies for itself. It was an empire. It was an organized imperial regime that needed to be able to use resources and have them at its disposal in different parts of the world in order to be able to promote its interests and fight its enemies. And so you don't keep your weapons all in one place in London. You got to spread them out. So there were military stores in Concord. With all of this increasingly angry argumentation going on, the British general, now in charge of Boston, realized he needed to go secure those supplies in Concord. Otherwise, he would be in danger, right? They could be seized by the colonists and then used against him, as he rightly anticipated. So he sent 800 troops to go and take control of those supplies. And then we have a famous story having to do with these riders. I love this illustration from a book of Paul Revere. He's a famous messenger in this moment here, who's delivering the message, the famous message. The British are coming! The British are coming! And everybody's waking up and, okay, now what? Well, remember that the First Continental Congress had said each colony needs to organize militia. It needs to organize citizens to be ready to answer the call whenever that comes whenever the moment arrives that we need to engage in armed resistance. So, here's a beautiful, beautiful symbolic statue of this symbolic figure. The statue is called the Minuteman. And that's indeed what happened. What the response was of the colonists was they had formed into militias and they were preparing to act in a coordinated manner. And the Minutemen were, as the name suggests, people who were ready to assemble. They were armed. They were ready to assemble and act as a militia in any capacity needed to defend the interests of the colonies. So the militia, the Minutemen assembled. In order to get to Concord, as the map suggests right here, you've got to be able to pass through Lexington. That was the trail. And so the Minutemen were assembled on Lexington Green, and now we have the confrontation. Colonists are arrayed, and the British are coming. They're organized, and the British commander, of course, yells at the colonists and tells them to throw down their arms and that he's there on lawful authority and so on, right? But we're past that point, right? This is the moment. This is the moment. How do revolutions happen? How do wars happen? It's kind of amazing, but they do resolve themselves to individual thoughts, to the actions of individuals in single moments. So this is just one of those times. It just gives me goosebumps to think about it, right? Because they're standing there and probably would not have found a man there who could have articulated it quite in this manner. But what was going to happen there was going to change the history of mankind. That's amazing. One of the things I love the most about history is when you encounter these things, that these moments, these individuals, these events, and you understand that the whole world is different because of what happened. That's amazing. That's why when this confrontation escalated and somebody, I don't even think we know his name, But somebody fired the first shot. And then, of course, you know what happens after that, right? We're looking at it here in this image. That shot came to be known as the shot heard round the world. I love that expression. That is just, to me, wonderful. Somebody knew there was thinking clearly when they thought of that idea. It was the shot heard round the world. Because that shot started the battle, started the war, started the revolution. And so the British, the great thing about the battles of Lexington and Concord was the British, I mean, did manage to repel these colonial minutemen who were not nearly as numerous as they needed to be to win this battle, but they withdrew but they had given the colonists enough time to sneak all the supplies away. So the British weren't able to get them, and had to retreat to Boston and they were attacked on their way back and so now we're at war. And then it just starts to pick up from here. We're not going to do a detailed history of the Revolutionary War. I think it is a fascinating story. It is a story that I enjoy a great deal. But it's not something that we need to focus on at this stage of learning. There are some really cool battles. And right at the beginning, we have a battle called the Battle of Bunker Hill, which is depicted in this painting. So the colonists, were at the top of these hills surrounding Boston, and the General Gage, who was in charge of Boston, realized that he could not hold the city. That's a really extreme tactical disadvantage to be at the bottom of a hill if you're fighting somebody. So they had to take the hill. The British marched up these hills. One was called Breed's Hill. The other was called Bunker Hill. And this painting is really cool. I mean, it's not like a great work of art or anything, but it's still a really apt illustration because you see these British soldiers, the red coats as they're known, right, marching in very careful order in that civilized manner of European warfare. And meanwhile, we've got these fences, and you see, you see what happened to the previous set that made their way up the hill in the same fashion, right? Because you can see these uniforms all over there, of those who've been slaughtered in the first rounds of the assault. Eventually, the American colonists ran out of bullets and they had to abandon Bunker Hill. And for a time, the British were completely in charge. But shortly thereafter, the Second Continental Congress was called. The Second Continental Congress came together before this battle. So it was already underway. I should put this, technically it was before. So they're getting together and all the colonies are discussing what this all means. And well, this is where they're finally going to decide, where does this take us? Right? If this is merely a rebellion, then it's going to look like all those other events in British history. After the rebellion is said and done, what happens? Even in some cases, like the events of the Magna Carta, what happens? Now you get a change, but maybe you get a little bit, you secure a little bit of progress. We go back to having a king. And then what happens? I lost you guys. You guys had enough for today? When I answer easy questions and you guys don't know the answer, I know that I've overtaxed you. All right. Well, we have reached the end for today. So I will answer the question. So what happens in these rebellions is you defeat the king. You force him to go back to treating you properly. But you go back to having a king. And pretty soon, same thing over and over again. Repeatedly, over. Over the never-ending argument of constitutional monarchy. Is that what this is about? Patrick Henry declares it is about liberty. Is the never-ending argument of constitutional monarchy, is that liberty? Is that enough? To live under the constant threat of the next round of tyranny, against which you will have to rise up and fight again to the death, gaining another temporary respite, and again and again. Is that liberty? Not to the founding fathers. They understood that liberty was more than that. And thus, they would have to define an outcome that was better than merely a rebellion. They would have to embark on a true, genuine revolution. All right, so there. Tomorrow we get there. Tomorrow we get to the revolution, the idea of a new kind of government. All right, guys. Have a good one. Talk to you tomorrow.
Bye, Mr. Powell.
Bye-bye.